welcome to Worlds Apart. Wars of choice have long become the US's preferred way of securing geopolitical dominance and feeding its insatiable military-industrial complex. But never before has it had a partner so eager and willing to host the bloodshed on its own territory. Ukraine volunteered to be the scene of the clash of major geopolitical doctrines, but how much longer is the West ready to avail of and pay for this sacrifice? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by SB Astana, a retired Major General in the Indian Army. General, it's great to see you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure speaking to you and your viewers.
Now, it's the third time we are discussing the conflict in Ukraine, and lately you observed that there has been a subtle yet noteworthy change in both the rhetoric and the dynamics on the battlefield. Let's start with the latter. You say that it's more a war of attrition at this point than anything else. Can you expand on that?
Let me give a context to it. That earlier when the war started, that is about 2.5 years back, that time initially in the special military operation, a maneuver warfare was taken into account in a manner that a deep objective in Ukraine, that is Kyiv, was threatened. The aim was that Ukraine had built very strong defenses against Donbass, and if you threaten a deep objective, then perhaps their defenses would be turned, as we call it in military. But to explain it in a simple language, I would say that they will be forced to take out some resources from the Donbass region to be able to protect Kyiv and Kharkiv. And that's why those maneuvers were taken. But as we read it, that those maneuvers certainly had a life for a simple reason, because when you get into built-up areas and there's a drone warfare, in that case, context, it so happened that you had a lot of casualties. At the same time, because you are short of infantry, so you couldn't hold those built-up areas. And therefore, it was thought that we must occupy a viable defense line. So they have to pull back. And when they pulled back from the Dnieper River, vacated Kharkiv, pulled back on the other side, same is the case with Kherson. So then it became a viable and a strong defense line to fall in. So
just to clarify, General, when you talk about they, you are talking about the Russian leadership, the Russian military leadership, right?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So this is how the Russian operations played up. And therefore, what we found thereafter was that once you had a viable defense line, then you could reduce your casualties and then you could move slowly. And then came the attrition warfare. In attrition warfare, you enmass your combat resources in a manner that you have superiority of the resources at the place of the conflict. And there you cause a lot of casualties and move. So you would have seen in the second year in Avdiivka, it was much smaller, a much slower movement, but a lot of attrition cost.
Well, let me ask you about that, because typically when belligerents pursue a war of attrition, they tend to go all out in terms of causing the damage. And I'm not sure this is exactly what we are seeing on either the Russian or the Ukrainian side. I have an impression that both sides need to pretend or need to show that the war effort goes on, that, you know, they are making gains without actually putting a lot of resources into that, or without actually even trying to hold on to those gains. What's underneath this somewhat sluggish or undecided war of attrition?
As of now, to save on casualties, both sides are looking at the standoff attacks. The standoff attacks by missiles, the standoff attacks by drones, and lesser troop-to-troop contact. And therefore, what is happening is that the progress of the operations becomes a little slower. And that is what we saw in the later part of the second year. Now, it is only last month that perhaps this frozen conflict to some extent was unfrozen by a quid pro quo action. Quid pro quo, that is a sudden action into the Kursk region. That was one. But then there again, there perhaps Ukraine has extended its front line, and it becomes slightly difficult for the deep penetration. At the same time, if their aim was to divert Russian attention from Donbass, that has not happened.
Can I ask you specifically about the Ukrainian incursion into mainland Russia? Because we've seen various estimates of how significant or insignificant it is. On the one hand, territorially, it seems rather impressive, around 1,300 square kilometers. But on the other side, Russians seem to be very chill about it. They evacuated population from those areas, and they are not putting a lot of resources into, quote-unquote, liberating it. How do you understand the rationale of those maneuvers on both sides?
See, from Russian point of view, I think it makes sense that they press on the Donbass region and complete the Donbass because they are very close to Pokrovsk. So if they capture that, then the consolidation of Donbass region would become easier, which is one of the aim of Russia. So that is, so they have not diverted any resources from there. They have now tried to contain the offensive in the Kursk region. So apparently what will happen is that maybe that the winters are about to come, let's say 2 months, as I visualize, they should capture Pokrovsk region and try and consolidate more on the Donbass region. And thereafter, once the winter set in, the evacuation of Ukrainians from there, from the wherever, whatever incursions they have made, would be perhaps be easy because of the stressed front line, Ukraine will have a problem of the manpower. Trained manpower is the most crucial aspect between the two sides. Russia has three times the manpower of Ukraine, and the trained manpower is also more. Now, West can supply, the US-led NATO can supply all kinds of military hardware, software, but then the fact is who is going to supply the people who are going to fight on ground. Mm-hmm. So that is what it can turn the tide subsequently, mm-hmm. as I visualize.
Especially since, as far as I understand the Russian thinking, they have absolutely no doubt that they will be able to retake those Russian territories back from the Ukrainians. Do you think there is any sort of any scenario in which Ukraine can actually hold on to the land that it is currently occupying in Russia?
Within 1 month, you cannot make the kind of defenses which are required to hold on against the counteroffensive of a professional army. If you recall, even for Russians to hold on to whatever they have captured in Ukraine, they took almost about 6 to 8 months to create a viable defense line on the home side of the riverbank, as well as creating the minefield and trenches, the line of minefield and trenches. And then only they could stabilize that whatever gains they had made. So it takes time. Getting into a territory is easy, but it takes time to build defenses, to build up the logistics, and to be able to control that area. So apparently, Russia has a little bit of time on their side in a manner that if they can do the main, see, their main objective is that they must get Donbass. Their corridor from Donbass to Crimea is well established, uh-huh. and they shouldn't lose out anything there. Uh-huh. So I think Russia is that well reasonably focused. Uh-huh. As far as Ukraine is concerned, they did it because they thought that they should show some development in a manner which can convince all their allies to give them more aid. That they still have not actually absolutely frozen the conflict. Uh-huh. So apparently there was a compulsion on the other side to do what they did.
You pointed out recently that the Western narrative has shifted from Putin must lose to Putin must not win, while the commitments to Ukraine have been refrained from we will support Ukraine as long as it takes to a less generous as long as we can. What do you think this subtle shift reflects?
See, these shifts have been brought by circumstances. If you recall, when the aid of $61 billion was stuck in the Congress, that time Joe Biden started saying, earlier he used to say, we will support Ukraine as long as it takes. And then when it got stuck, he started saying, we will support as long as we can. And it is also related to the kind of manufacturing which the West, entire West could do. Russia could hike up their defense production by 400%. The West could hike up only by 20%. So that was one of the reasons. Now, second part is that earlier they used to say Putin must lose. But now they have realized that Russia cannot lose. It's a very large country with the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons. So losing is out of question. Similarly, Putin is still very much in power. As far as all the Western leaders are concerned, everybody is struggling to remain in power. So they are becoming now really a little more realistic, perhaps, towards the situation on ground. Mm-hmm.
Now, I also heard you say in another interview that by and large, Russia has accomplished its goals and has a clear upper hand on the battlefield and in terms of medium-term or long-term resourcing of this conflict. Is it ultimately in Russia's interest right now to aim for a permanent settlement? And is a permanent settlement possible at this point, given that the West is so infatuated with various deflection tactics? It usually, you know, strikes some agreement only to abandon them later. So does it make sense for Russia to try to put an end, official end to this conflict, or keep it at the this current low level?
To decide on this, we have to firstly see what was the aim and how much they have achieved. The Russian aim was political aim was that they must arrest the trend of Western expansion of NATO. Now, whatever NATO had to expand, they have expanded. Finland is with them. Ukraine, I don't think it will get included into NATO. It's a question mark there whether it will get included or not. But there is no more scope to expand. Now, as far as political aim of Russia is concerned, the aim was that they must get Donbass, they must have a corridor right up to Crimea so that there is a land corridor. If possible, the aim plus was, if they can join up with Transnistria and landlock Ukraine, then they will have a free hand as far as Black Sea is concerned. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as continental war is concerned, I think Russia has done well so far. But the question is now with this Kursk offensive and the Donetsk region not being completely in their hand, it may be premature as of now from the military point of view, to go for a peace negotiation. They can still achieve a little more to have a better bargaining position, and they must get the Ukrainians out maybe immediately after that. Mm-hmm. So as of now, the complete aim is not achieved. They have achieved most of it. Now, if we look at the other side, if it goes for negotiation, they have to lose territory. It's as simple as that. So therefore, they will not like to lose. And secondly, if the American aim was, as you also mentioned in the commentary, that the war must go on, the the arms industry must prosper, and the Russian influence should go down and Russian oil should not flow into Europe, and influence should also get reduced. If that was the aim, then they would like to continue the war till the time their soldiers are not dying. It is Ukrainians who are dying. So till the time last Ukrainian standing, they won't mind continuing it, unless it becomes economical or becomes a bigger pain for the other side. Mm-hmm. So in my opinion, both sides for a negotiation have to agree first. I don't think that stage has been crossed as of now.
Well, General, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this conversation in a few moments. Stay tuned.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with SB Astana, a retired Major General in the Indian Army. General, before the break, you mentioned the issue of NATO, which is still the biggest elephant in the room, so to say. And President Putin said in several of his interviews that his American counterparts, American presidents, can come and go. They can say whatever they want to. But the U.S. posture vis-a-vis foreign countries, including Russia, is determined by other forces. like, for example, the military-industrial complex, which relies on conflicts. At least that's Moscow's view. It relies on conflicts, wars of choice, to sustain itself. Given that strategy that NATO's expansion has been pursued by and large for 30 years now by every single American president since Bill Clinton, do you think the Ukrainian conflict will be enough, if not to reverse it, then at least plant some second thoughts in the minds of American leaders as to how effective that is? Because clearly that strategy didn't work with Russia. It may have worked with other smaller countries with lesser military, but it hasn't worked out with Russia.
Yes, I agree that they have faced problems with Russia as far as this strategy is concerned, but they will continue progressing it because as far as USA is concerned, the deep state, that is the arms industry, that calls the shot. And for arms industry to flourish, the wars must happen. And even if the wars don't happen, the threat must remain because it is the threat which forces the European countries to buy American equipment. Similarly, why actually they are expanding? If they say that it is a defensive organization, NATO, then the reason is why they expand is that more are the number of countries in NATO, more are the captive buyers of that arms industry. So that interest is not going to change. And that is the reason why what we call as Cold War 1.0 between Russia and USA, which should have ended with the end of Second World War, but it has continued and continued so far. And I don't visualize that this interest is going to go down as far as USA is concerned. As far as the other areas are concerned, they've also started off with Cold War 2.0 with China. And there also, there is an insecurity created and there are a number of countries which also face the Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific. And those countries, again, are now lagging on to this arms industry and sale of arms.
Now, selling arms and fighting an actual war are two different things. And I'm sure you know that Russia's military doctrine states pretty clearly that if Russia starts losing in a conventional war, it intends to use tactical nuclear weapons first, and then if its survival as a sovereign state is threatened, it has these strategic nuclear weapons to rely on. And this is not just a declaration or a strategy. Moscow has invested, diligently invested in modernizing its nuclear potential. Based on that factor, I don't understand why would Russia's defeat or even deliberate weakening be in anyone's interest? Wouldn't that create a much larger problem for the U.S. military-industrial complex, because it can produce arms, but it's not quite sure, I am at least not quite clear, that it can actually fight wars, major wars, with its own soldiers, with its own military personnel?
The Americans are smart enough that they will stop before a nuclear exchange starts. So, therefore, what they are trying to do is, you see this conflict itself, Ukraine may be the battleground. There is a contact war between Russia and Ukraine, contact kinetic war. But the bigger war is the non-kinetic, non-contact war between the US-led NATO and Russia, which is in economic domain, political domain, diplomatic domain, and cyber domain and information warfare domain. Now, these are the wars which they are going to continue to fight. So basically, they need not fight. But if they can create the threat of Russia into some of these countries, those countries will be forced to buy. Today, Europe has compromised their energy interest to some extent in favor of USA only because they have not prepared themselves to a potential threat or so-called threat created by Russia as far as the information warfare is concerned. And that is why they are hostage to a certain amount of decision-making by USA. So this is the kind of situation which perhaps many countries in the Indo-Pacific also would face. And that is where perhaps they will be able to sell their arms and still keep the escalation ladder and escalation dynamics in a manner that it does not get into a nuclear holocaust or a nuclear exchange between USA and Russia.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Europe, and it is pretty obvious that this conflict came into being because of the very divergent views on the security architecture in Europe. And those agreements are still smoldering. There is very little trade or diplomatic activity between Russia and Western Europe, but they are still neighbors. How do you envisage them living side by side in the decades to come? Will it be more like India and Pakistan or something else?
See, you can't choose neighbors. So neighbors will remain there, and therefore both have to coexist and coexist together. That's a compulsion. Now, how do we coexist? So as far as what I visualize is, as far as Russia and Europe are concerned, the threat is there, certainly. But even when the war is on, Europeans are still buying Russian oil, may not be directly, but indirectly. And the sale has not, reduced. So long Russia has the resources, and so long Europe needs the resources, this partnership is not going to change. But one thing which I certainly visualize, that as part of the strategy, Americans will make sure, and Ukrainians will also make sure, if it is the same leader, unless a pro-Russian leader comes there subsequently, they will make sure that there is some kind of insurgency in the areas of Donbass, and this insurgency will prevail. And therefore, in that context, you may find that today we are living with Pakistan. They are doing proxy war, and we keep giving them warning, and at times take certain actions to put them in place. But notwithstanding that, that is the kind of relationship which we are living with. In case the proxy war, they resort to proxy war, then this kind of relationship may come up. But I think the geography also will change. The geography of Ukraine will also change to some extent or the other. I don't visualize that Ukraine will be exactly the same as it was earlier. And so is the case with the relationship.
Now, this conflict is remarkable in many ways, but I think Ukraine's willingness to endure all of that, to host on their land this amazing and humongous and horrible in many ways bloodshed is pretty striking. And to this day, Ukrainian officials proudly describe their country as a testing ground for the most modern weapons, hoping perhaps that such a pitch would secure them enough support from abroad. To me, that's a weird type of glory. But do you think it's appealing enough to keep this war going? Do you think the appetite of the military-industrial complex, American or Western military-industrial complex, will run out at a certain point? Is there hope for that?
I visualize that the manpower problem of Ukraine will run out earlier than the military-industrial complex. The reason is military-industrial complex would like to sell as many weapons as they can. The amount of aid which is being given to Ukraine, everything is not aid. There are a whole lot of loan component into that. Ukraine cannot pay back. So obviously, there are some industries who would like to buy a certain real estate, and Ukraine may have to perhaps compromise with some kind of real estate as well. So there are a lot of economic interests involved. But as far as Ukraine is concerned, perhaps Ukrainians will have to decide for themselves as to what they want to do. They are the ones who have lost maximum. As far as the appetite to continue this war is concerned, I visualize that this appetite is going to go down. Europeans have started realizing that they need to perhaps look at their interests first. A number of countries are behaving in that manner. Everybody is not on board. The industrial complex is concerned, they will do the cost-benefit analysis. The day America feels that economically now we are wearing down, we are losing down, and in case the Indo-Pacific heats up, then Americans will have a compulsion. Because if their reserves of the arms and ammunition are down, then they have a problem in South China Sea also. In that case also, there may be a compulsion to close this side or to draw down on supporting the war this side. Mm-hmm.
And General, if I may ask you one last question, as a former military commander, you mentioned before that the manpower is perhaps the issue that's going to decide the outcome of this conflict more than any type of weaponry. And we all assume that soldiers are ready to die for their countries. And yet we also hope that those sacrifices will be valued, that they would be worthwhile, and that people will not be thrown into a meat grinder for some unrealistic geopolitical initiative of some high-minded individuals. Now, when you look at the death toll on both sides, when you look at the rationale behind various maneuvers, when you look at the level of training that people undergo, what's your take on that? How do you feel about it as somebody who I assume also had to, you know, be in charge of fates of many people?
See, as far as the soldiers are concerned, I mean, their grit and determination to fight for the country is always well respected, irrespective of which side they are, including whether of all countries, we salute and respect everybody. As far as the political game is concerned, now a number of times it just so happens that for a political game of a country maybe a few leaders, the wars do happen and soldiers do bear the brunt. And more than the soldiers, the people also bear the brunt. Obviously, the Ukrainian people, the kind of displacements which have taken place, and both sides, also on the Russian side, a number of casualties have taken place. So the war is a costly affair for both. As far as the trained manpower is concerned, that is an asset. And I continue to say so, because that is making a lot of difference. You see, NATO cannot put its soldier in Ukraine, because if it does so, then as per Article 5, the Third World War starts, and then Russia would be inclined to use the nuclear option. So that cannot, that should, that I think would be a red line. Short of that, they may allow them to use long-range weapons, etc., etc., but that that doesn't change the dynamics. The problem is that certainly the trained manpower is important. The welfare is also important. And as far as the morale is concerned, that is also dictated whether it is a just war or otherwise. Independence is dear to everybody, and that is what the soldiers are fighting for. But then the problem is somebody has to decide that, okay, you can say that, okay, I'm protecting my sovereignty from Russia, but then your sovereignty is so much hostage to USA now that even to present your war plan, you have to go and present it to not only the ruling party, but also to the opposition. So where is the case of sovereignty? Are you actually fighting for sovereignty? So these are the things which perhaps Ukraine has to do soul searching, whether they are actually fighting for the right cause or otherwise.
Well, hopefully they will sooner or later fight for their own cause. This is the only thing that can actually stop this conflict, at least in my view. But we have to end it here. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.